Sandman is the story of the place that we go when we close our eyes at night, and it's called the Dreaming. And the Dreaming is ruled by Morpheus. For 32 years, anybody who read Sandman, read the comics, that world is ending. I'm here at Shepperton Studios, and I'm getting to see what happens when you bring dreams to life.
I'm someone who is an obsessive Sandman fan. It's an awesome responsibility because it's something that is so beloved.
I read the Sandman graphic novels, so I knew that I simply had to be involved in this project because something truly unique was going to happen.
The following program has adult language and plenty of spoilers. Listener, be advised.
Sandman, Neil Gaiman's magnum opus. Because he's a famous novelist, he might think of the books as that, but in comics, it'd be The Sandman. How were you introduced to that book?
I bought the trade from your shop.
So you didn't get to read it until after the series had already ended.
Correct.
Pretty much then, right? Because when did that one end? It was already over with by the time you started, right?
No, because I have the... When did the miniseries for Death come out?
Well, there were two miniseries.
The first one.
The first
where
one, I want to say, was...
Chris Bocciolo artwork and all that.
I think they both had Chris Bocciolo artwork. I want to say, like, 92, 91, 92, because they... Vertigo started, what, 92, 93? I want to say that the Death, the High Cost of Living miniseries, the first miniseries, was under the Vertigo banner if that already had started. And I think it was a couple of years later that they did the second miniseries.
I think because I have a issue one of autographed by the artist that I saw at a convention.
Okay.
So that series was going on. And I only bought it because I had read the trades up to that point.
Okay.
But I don't know if the series had ended or not by that point.
Okay. So what got you to reading The Sandman?
You told me to read it.
And where did you start?
Doll's House?
Doll's House, okay.
Yeah, the first one. You sold me. I still have the copy. It's all beat to shit. I still have that one. You sold me Doll House, and then the next one is...
Dream Country. Was it Dream Country? Was the one after that, yeah.
Yeah, because I've only read, like, the first two trades.
You never read the whole series?
No, I've never read the whole series.
Wow, okay.
Again, I sporadically read some, so I'll read some, and then I don't think I didn't acquire those trades till later.
Yeah,
and so I want to go back and reread the first trades to kind of, you know how I am. I like
so
to
you never read Preludes and Nocturnes.
Which one is that one?
That's the first trade.
Yes. No. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. So Nocturne. I read that one.
Okay.
And Dollhouse. When does Dollhouse come out?
That was the second trade.
Okay, so I read the first, the second, and a little bit of Dream Country, but I don't think that's the third.
So you never
one.
Made it to Season of Mist?
No.
Okay. Interesting.
But
okay.
I didn't acquire those till later. I had the hardcover ones, but I didn't acquire those till later. But I remember I bought the first two from you because I think I bought at that time I bought both of those, and then I bought early Hellblazer. You had Hellblazer on those. I bought those.
Jamie Yellenow stuff.
No, well, yeah, the Garthenas.
The Garthenas stuff
because that's what got me into Garthenas. And so I remember you sold me that and something else. All of a sudden, and I remember thinking because it was all DC stuff.
Yeah,
and I wasn't a DC guy.
Well, it is interesting because we've talked in the past how you got into Alan Moore and you got way into Alan Moore and you've collected almost everything he's ever written for the most part. I mean, we were at a bookstore earlier today and you're like, yeah, well, Jeffrey Saga, you know, but that's pretty, you're kind of scraping, you know, when you get to that point. And then, of course, Garth Ennis, you were very committed to, and you've read a whole bunch of Garth Ennis and stuff. So I guess the Neil Gaiman didn't grab you the same way, though, because you haven't committed.
Well, I actually read his books, though.
Which ones?
Those are the Gods.
American Gods.
American Gods. Is that the one they made a TV series out of, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, so I read American Gods. I've seen two seasons of that.
That was such an interesting premise. And, like, we got the book on the audiobook.
Yeah.
And we were for a road trip. And we got a few chapters in. And we lost interest, and then I tried to watch the TV show. I got an episode or two in, lost interest. So it's a cool premise, but I just couldn't get into it.
I think I read his Norris
Norse mythology.
Norse mythology was pretty good. There was one other book of his I read. So I actually dipped in. Well, so I read that, and which led me to go read some of his other, like his DC stuff that he was doing.
What about Good Omens, the one he did with Terry Pratchett that they adapted on Amazon?
No, I've seen the show, but I never read the book.
And that's another one I bought. If I remember correctly, I bought that book and I started reading it and I didn't finish it.
Really?
Yeah.
I mean, I enjoy his writing.
How about the children's stuff? The Graveyard Book or Coraline?
Coraline, I've seen the movie. I've never read the
love
book.
Love the movie. Love that movie. We saw it years back.
I'm trying to think, what of his is that I've read? I mean, of course, because he also wrote Miracle Man, I started tracking his Miracle Man stuff because he was the writer after Alan Moore. Didn't he write something else? I mean, I vaguely remember where he wrote. Didn't he write like a JLA or like the?
No, I don't think he ever did anything with JLA.
Yeah, like a trade, like a, or a pristine book.
I don't think so. I know that
with the Green Lantern and all that.
You're talking about the one with Superman and Green Lantern with the Frank Miller cover.
Well, yes,
that was supposed to be serialized in Action Comics Weekly before they canceled that format and went back to being a regular Superman title.
Okay,
and so I don't know if it had been drawn. I know it had been written, but I'm not sure if it had been drawn by the time they canceled that format. And then, of course, once Neil Gaiman got to be a big name, you know, they got the script in the drawer. So they finally put that out as like a prestige format one shot. And so you read that one.
Read that one. So, yeah, I mean, I've read.
What about Whatever Happened to the Caped Crusader?
No.
Okay.
No, I never read that
one. That's another one where it's almost like a direct response to an Alan Moore story. So that's why I was curious if that was really something you'd check Superman out. And you like Batman, yeah.
Yeah. No, I never read that. I mean, Batman's kind of
weird. What about Eternals?
I read his Eternals.
Yeah.
But I actually like the Austin's Eternals more.
Oh, yeah. Chuck Austin?
Charles Hawks. Yeah, because he had a more fucked up take on him.
Right.
Where I like Neil Gaiman, but he tends to write, and I really, really like his stuff, but some of it's a little too hotty-totty, kind of.
Yeah.
Very English.
Where, oh, yes.
Yeah, and so he's not a Garth Ennis, where Garth Ennis will take you in a fucking dark place.
Well, and also, you're talking about an Englishman versus Irishman.
True.
I think that's well illustrated by
the... But he does write at courses. A level of literature. Like, his stuff is literature.
Yeah.
Where Garth Ennis is not going to be considered literature.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes you want filet mignon, but sometimes you just want a burger and fries.
Yeah.
And most people just want a burger and fries because it's quick and enjoyable. You can move on wherever. Steak, it's a whole production. So to me, when I read Neil Gaiman stuff, it's a little bit of a production. Like, you have to go in there. You know already he's going to stretch your mind with some fucking words and phrases and concepts that you're going to really have to... Like, you have to really pay attention when you're reading Neil Gaiman shit.
But at the same time, you know, Alan Moore does similar things and you've...
But he goes much in a more fucked up traffic. Direction. But he goes in a fucked up direction. I mean, when you have like Kid Kaboom from like Miracle Man going around fucking raping characters and shit like that. And like, but Alan Moore does more of like a deconstruction of a character and then takes him to a dark place. Garth Ennis just does fucked up shit for fun.
Right.
Where Neil Gaiman, like, he does it
more flowery.
Yeah, but
prettier, gentler.
It's a very English way to go fucked up.
Right.
I mean, because I mean his...
Well, I mean, Alan Moore's English.
Yeah, he's a wizard and shit like that. I don't hear Neil Gaiman like throwing spells and shit.
Not enough drugs, basically, is part of
Neil Gaiman's enough problem. Neuroses and shit. Like,
yeah.
You know, Alan Moore's really from what I've read, don't know the guy personally, but from what I've read, you know, his mind takes him to a very dark place. But again, you have to, if you're going to write like League of Extraordinary Gentlemen and stuff like that, stuff that balances so well with I know people who read that stuff and they're like, oh, it's literature, because he's taking literal literature characters and writing
and mythological
too, and creating a world for them. But at the same time, he's doing really fucked up shit where, like, you know, Mr. Hyde is fucking eating the Invisible Man and shit like that. Right. So, I mean, he straddles that really well. I don't see Neil Gaiman doing stuff like that.
Mm.
His stuff gets dark, but it's still in a very intellectual way. So, right. And then, of course, Garth Ennis will have some dude with a fucking pig's head, you know, severed pig's head over his head, running around with a chainsaw, with a dildo hanging between his legs. So, you know, choose your poison.
More fun. Okay. So, for me, I'm not sure how I became aware of The Sandman. I was looking at the timetable using Mike's Amazing World of Comics. I'm assuming that there must have been a little bit of buzz in like comic shop news, and maybe I got a hold of some trade stuff because there's really no reason. I remember
seeing posters.
Yeah, so maybe I would see like stuff
like Death's posters. I remember seeing a lot of posters of her, like back when Third Planet like had multiple stores. I remember going in there. That's when, you know, it felt more like a head shop. So you would walk in there, and I remember seeing they had the posters they would get out of promotionals.
Yeah,
and I remember seeing Death because she was very striking. This black and white.
Well, it's like if you went to a head shop or a record store, you'd probably see Susie Sue somewhere.
True.
And you can kind of see being transposed.
When I think of that, I immediately go to Judas Priest, where you have the giant, like, armored tiger or leopard, like, leaping. And then you had the eagle with all the armor.
Yeah.
I mean, it was just one of those images.
What I'm saying is, like, if we'd gone to, like, not necessarily Spencer's, I want to say... Probably Puff and Stuff from that time period. But I would go there and you'd see, like, some of the cool alternate bands and people that I knew of by reputation but hadn't necessarily had a lot of first-hand experience with. Again, like Susie and the Banshees or The Cure.
Yeah.
I had some exposure to them, but it was later on before I really got to be familiar with them. And so I think maybe part of it was that they looked like Robert Smith and Susie Sue. It might have been why, you know, they was like almost like, oh, these must be the cool kids, you know, these must be the cool characters. Maybe some word of mouth, I don't know. But at the time that I finally became a buyer of the Sandman comic books, this was before I was getting any advanced catalogs, no advanced comics previews, anything like that. I wasn't doing any pre-ordering. And in fact, the specific month, I wasn't even having contact with Comic Shop. I think that was during during a time period where I was still buying off of the convenience store newsstand or the mall spinner racks like B. Dalton and Walden Books. I just didn't have access. And so I was going to visit my brother, and he had a local comic shop, and he bought a lot of stuff there. And I've almost never got to be on his side of town to check out his stuff and go to his comic shop, but we did that. And I had a number of options of what to buy, but I specifically remember buying the last part of Season of Mists, which is a very foolish thing to do because, as you mentioned, Neil Gaiman is a very literate writer. And so I'm coming in. It's not even really the end of the story. It's almost like an epilogue, like the coda to the story instead. And I don't know who any of these people are. I don't know what the hell's going on. But I read that last chapter and it interested me. And of course, the Dave McKean covers were much more abstract than anything I was used to before. I believe that Mike Ringenberg was the one who drew that last issue. So I guess that for me, he was the initial Sandman artist of note. And when I went back, of course, he had a pretty high presence on the book in that time period. But I was interested enough that I continued to pick it up. But again, I still had limited comic shop access. But as it happened, I managed to make a trip to Third Planet like a month or two later. And I got like one or two issues off of their stand because, again, I didn't have access to this stuff. And just around that time period is when I finally started ordering comics like pre-order. So it was just the right time to where I could actually continue to buy the Sandman after that first exposure. And I was enjoying what I was reading quite a bit. And then we moved to another state. And again, I'm pulling stuff off. I eventually find a comic shop and I'm able to fill in the gaps of what I had missed and continue on from there. And so I continued to buy the Sandman more or less monthly until the last issue, issue 75. So I was pretty much locked in. And it was really not so much that final chapter of the Season of Mists, but it was the individual done-in-one stories that came afterwards. Mm-hmm. I believe it was called Distant Windows, I think it was called. And that's what really hooked me in. But that's not what we're talking about today. So after having bought that stuff, I think that the comic shop either had a copy of The Doll's House already in the shop so I could pick it up, or that's the one that I had heard the most about by reputation, because I think I'd already heard that maybe the first trade wasn't the hottest. And so I bought The Doll's House, and I started buying back issues to fill in the gaps going backwards for quite a ways. And so that was my entry into The Sandman. And like I said, it was impactful on me. I was enough of a fan where I continued buying it right up until the very end. The Sandman comics that I read showed me that you could do more with comic books than I had thought possible up to that point. So it was definitely revolutionary for me. Mm-hmm. So probably that's another instance where I've always said that Alan Moore, one of the reasons why I don't think I ever hooked into him the way that most people did, is he just got to me too late. I was exposed to Pat Mills. I was exposed to Neil Gaiman. And so between those two, and Garth Ennis eventually as well, a few years later, between those people, the stuff that I think that the synapses that were fired by Alan Moore were fired in me by other people. And so my loyalties are more to them than to Alan Moore, right? Okay. So eventually I did go back and read Preludes and Nocturnes. I don't remember if I think I had it as a trade paperback. And let me go ahead and bring out, I've got my copy of the hardcover. You can give that a quick toss and you can see if you recognize that story. What does kill me though is I don't know if the comic shop I was going to ever had a copy of the first issue of Sandman. If they did, it was probably way more expensive than I could afford, probably in like the $40 range, which would have been way too much for me to consider. But I'm pretty confident I know for a fact they had the Sandman number 8. And I want to say they had it for like $15 to $20. And the problem is when I had a little bit of money, my commitment, the thing that I felt that I needed just to get money to buy, was Rob Liefeld's New Mutants issues. And I do feel some regret over that. Now, if I'd kept more of those, and if I'd made a point of buying my own copy of New Mutants 98 in particular, I'd probably been a happy camper today. But at the time, I did not get that first appearance of Death, which is worth considerably more money now than it used to be. And also, I never did get, and I ended up selling off all of my Liefeld New Mutants when I had the comic shop. So I have nothing to show for any of those purchases in that time period.
I don't remember the Martian Manhunter showing up in it.
Mm-hmm. Or do you recognize the story?
Oh, yeah. It's something from the TV show.
Right, but did you ever actually read the comic book?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, okay. No, yeah. Oh, yeah, like the serial killer, the doctor, what's his name?
Dr. Destiny.
That's what I told you. When I watched the show, I knew what stories they were telling because I've read those.
Yeah.
I mean, if most people who are like, oh, I've read Sandman will say, oh, I read at least the first two trades. Mm-hmm. I've never met, I mean...
Well, that's one of the things.
Those are the ones that I remember were like. Matter of fact, I remember you specifically told me because I told you how much I liked. Was it Warren Ellis?
Okay,
because he had done Druid, and I remember telling you how fucked up it was, and you're like, oh well, you'll like, you know,
The Doll's House.
Yeah, well, no, you were like, I remember you telling me, oh, well, you're gonna like Garth Ennis in Constantine or Hellblazer. So I started reading that, and I was like, wow, this is really cool. And then you were like, if you like fucked up shit, then you really want to read this one because that's serial killers and so I don't remember if you sold them to me in that order, but I remember that's kind of where the conversation went. But okay. I was hooked first on Warren Ellis because I read Druid and thinking, like, I think he even fucks a tree or something.
Well, yes, he does. That's how they manage to kill him. It's like the Druid's weakness.
Yeah, and I was just like, I remember thinking, like, this is fucked up. And so...
And at some point, you went back and you got the Hellstorm stuff that
Ellis wrote. Oh, yeah. Well, I got the Hellstorm stuff. I got his Thor stuff that he wrote. Mm-hmm. But I remember thinking, like, I didn't think people wrote comic books like that. Especially a Marvel character. Because I knew Druid from, like, I guess West Coast Avengers?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember thinking, like, oh, he's a poor man's Doctor Strange. Right. I got you. But
when balding and portly.
Yeah. But you got him fucking a tree and stuff. And I'm like, okay, that's different. Mm-hmm. And so I like that. And then you turned me... I remember the next one, it had to be Garth Enix. Because I remember reading the first trade and, like, going to the shop and asking, like, are there any more trades of this? And I think you had, like, two more. And I really found his stuff really good. And then I was already kind of into Alan Moore, I think. I can't remember. I just remember I was really into, like, Warren Ellis, Alan Moore. Neil Gaiman, not so much. Because I want to say you sold me the trade. I didn't read it right away. But when I read it, I really enjoyed it. Right. I think what it was the artwork kind of
thing. Yeah, I was about to say, is you were very much more art inclined when we first met. And the art on that book is not what was popular in that time period.
I want to say maybe that was a little bit of the, I'm not in a rush to read this. Because the artwork was a little bit outside my norm.
Yeah.
Where the other stuff was like...
Leonardo Manco was a little bit more your
taste. Yeah, that was within my wheelhouse. I was fine with that.
Still, dark, still moody, but a little more polished, a little more detailed.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so I knew what I was reading, where when I got to this... I mean, I remember enjoying it immensely when I read it, to the point where I bought the trades and I've tried to buy the hard covers ever since.
Yeah, so I want to say probably in the introduction to The Doll's House, Neil Gaiman talked a little bit about how Sandman came to be, and there was a sense of him saying that the first arc was him figuring out what the book even was. Because the story goes, they had Alan Moore, they might have had Grant Morrison by that point, I think they had with Doom Patrol and everything.
Oh, Grant Morrison, another one. Thank you.
Right. Man. Yeah, that's another favorite of yours. And then so Karen Berger went to the UK to look for more of that. You know, people really seem to like that. There's an instance where you could probably get away with paying a Brit writer quite a bit less than it would cost to get a name American writer and a hot artist.
Yeah.
You could just get a Brit writer and you'd have a certain sort of street cred with the intellectuals. They'd be more inclined to buy it. And so they wanted more of that. And so Neil Gaiman had been trying to break into comic books for a little while there. I think he'd done some stuff in the UK, like maybe some 2000 AD or something, but nothing really that major.
Or anything, or?
I don't think so. I think he just did some general 2000 AD stuff. Most everybody broke in there to begin with. But he was really a journalist at that point. But he also had friends in the artistic community. I think he must have done some stuff with Dave McKeon. Maybe they'd done like Violent Cases or something by that point, like some like graphic novels and stuff. And so they were sort of a package deal. And so Berger met with him and they talked about what he could do. And apparently at that time he still had a more of a heavy English accent and probably a little less refined too. I think sometimes he maybe talks up to a level he may not have actually been at the time. And so he said he wanted to do a book, Black Hawk Kid. And so Berger's thought, do we own a character named Black Hawk Kid? And eventually it was determined, no, he's talking about Black Orchid, the obscure 70s supernatural heroine shit. And so he had done that many series, and it took me years to get around to reading that. In part because I've never been a huge Dave McKean fan. I'm not really into his art style. I know you probably like him from Arkham Asylum, which he did with Grant Morrison. And since that came out right around the same time as the first Batman movie, that book sold so well that Matt Morrison bought a house with the royalties.
Oh, wow.
You know, he bought his first house with the royalties. But I'm not, you know, I mean, I respect the covers that he did on Sandman, but it's just never been my bag. It's sort of like you with Mike Gringenberg. I just don't, his stuff doesn't draw me in. And so I've read, like, Mr. Punch, and I've read some of the other stuff that they did together in collaboration. I did eventually read Black Orchid. I just wasn't that into it. It just didn't work for me. I did get a hold of a copy of one of the issues of the Books of Magic. I think it was the one that Scott Hampton did. I think it had a John Bolton cover, and that really impressed me, and I really liked that. But he was still like kind of wanting to be Alan Moore, and a lot of that work reflected that. And so when he goes in the Sandman, as you pointed out when you flip through the story, there's a lot of DC tie-in material in here. There's stuff from the New Gods, particularly Mr. Miracle, you know, John Jones and Martian Manhunter, and some of the other members of the Justice League International have appearances. The main villain is Dr. Destiny, who was in one of the earliest Justice League stories. He was introduced as a plainclothes individual who put together like a team to fight the Justice League at one point, and it wasn't until I think the 70s before he started writing off the skull mask and the cowl and everything. And curiously, he was in the one issue of Who's Who I bought when the book was actually coming out. I only ever bought a issue of that book new because it kind of turned me off. I didn't like, I thought the DC characters were too corny, but he happened to be in that one, so I had some familiarity with him from that. But yeah, it's him trying to do something very similar to what Alan Moore was doing with things like the American Gothic story, or American Nightmare, was it? Where he brought in all the supernatural characters and team up and stuff. Because that's the thing. something, they didn't do a lot of that before Alan Moore. There was that one Blue Devil summer special where they had like Man-Bat and Black Orchid and the Demon and a few other people. But that was kind of a goof. Mm-hmm. Actually getting those characters and taking them seriously and doing like horror stuff with these supernatural characters, not really, it's just like a shared universe, though we're a superhero universe. A lot of that really came from Alan Moore, and it seemed like he was trying to continue along those lines, and probably these early arcs is him trying to do what Alan Moore did before he started to figure out who he was. And probably quite notably, Sam Keith was the original artist on The Sandman, which seems like a pretty big get, you know, in retrospect. But at this time, I think he mostly just done some stuff with Bill Willingham. You know, he really hadn't broken out or anything by this point. And I gotta be honest with you, I really don't like Sam Keith's art in this for initial art. It was probably something that worked reasonably well to stand apart from some of the other DC supernatural stuff, since a lot of them had that kind of rough style. And that roughness is present here too, but it also had some of the more creepy style exaggeration, particularly when it came to Dream with his big xenomorph cowl thing and everything. And then of course, I think there was a strong grounding element with Mike Rinchenberg, making it look more like something like Swamp Thing, essentially. Mm-hmm. I mean, when you look at the combination of these two, it reminds me a lot of like Steve Bissett when he was doing Swamp Thing.
Yeah.
And I don't think it's doing either one of them any favors. So it was weird watching the adaptation on Netflix. I don't know about you, I never expected they were going to be that literal. And they more or less adapted like an issue or two, like roughly one or two issues per episode.
Yeah.
Do you think that was to its benefit?
Yes, because the writing is already strong enough that newcomers would enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, if you've read this stuff, you'd been like, oh, it's, you know, old hat. I know this.
Yeah.
But now it's, you know, it's moving, it's talking, it's breathing, it's interacting. I enjoyed it. I thought the whole first season was fantastic.
So, in a nutshell, what's happening in the early episodes? What's happening in those initial stories?
Well, theirs is a little different because Dream creates, I guess, nightmares because to live in people's lives. And it follows the book where, you know, the guy's trying to capture death, but he accidentally catches sleep or Dream. And I mean, dude, even the actor looked, I thought he looked great. He looked just like Dream, I thought.
The one thing that got me is
the voice.
The voice was a little affected. Yeah.
I was fine with that.
I thought that one of the reasons they might have gotten him is because they wanted a really tall, lanky guy. Because he seems on the show like he's like 6'7" or some shit. But no, he's like 5'11" or some stuff. He's not particularly tall. It's just he looks, and I think they maybe CGI enhanced his thinness.
I don't think
he's legitimately that thin.
Maybe. I mean,
but it feels like sometimes he's like puckering his face intentionally, like he's trying to look more crooked. Yeah. And the voice kind of feels somewhat affected. I guess he has a deep voice, but sometimes it's like really.
Well, no, it's very velvety, kind of. It's very dreamlike, but they follow the book pretty closely where he's trapped. But that was the thing in the book, it was like a sleeping disease, and everyone fell asleep, and that's where you get the whole thing about like the what was she called, the incursion or whatever.
The ringlet, but something it's a reference to a ring, but it's an old term.
Is that
for a ring?
Is that in the comic?
Yeah, I believe that is. Yeah, but that's the thing too, is you're talking about something that's really the second arc.
Yeah,
and one thing they did that was interesting on the TV show season is they intermingled the first two arcs together.
Yeah. I didn't particularly care for their version of Sandman, the kid, and I hate the
fact. Oh, you mean the fact? Well, okay, but let's not stay with the first story though. Like, what else happens in that first story?
Well, dude, it's all over the place. They, like you said, they blended in multiple stories to create a whole new story. So you have, you know, was it Corinthian running around, which I don't believe he appears in the first book.
No. He's definitely introduced in the doll's house.
Yeah. So like,
but again, there's a lot of attempts to tie the Sandman into DC continuity in the comics. And it seems like there's a lot of effort to extricate the Sandman from any of the other DC materials they're doing.
Yeah.
Well, not just that, but also this is a Netflix series and you have the DCEU actually progressing. And so there's these characters that are already taken, that are already spoken for essentially. And one of the things I was intrigued by as I'm watching the show is who was going to stay and who was going to go. Like, I was really happy to see they got Cain and Abel.
I knew they had to. They're crucial.
Well, yeah, and it really helps me to invest when they're not trying to like. And again, these are biblical characters, so they could have gone further astray and still have them be Cain and Abel.
But I like the fact that they look so close.
Yeah, they look like the characters. Yeah, and I like too they cast Semitic actors so that they would look like a Cain and Abel ought to look like. That they look like the combo characters, but you also know they're from the region and they're appropriate to the region, so that it fits with the biblical lore as well. What did you think about Lucien becoming Lucien with like an extra extra E and an N where she goes from probably an English white guy to a black woman.
What do you mean?
Remember how they changed the librarian? The librarian of the dreaming.
Oh,
Lucien.
Yeah. Actually, I didn't notice that.
You didn't notice it?
No, I didn't. No.
Went from a white guy to a black chick?
Yeah, no.
Okay. But how did you feel about that actor?
No, she did fine. I mean, again, I haven't read this series in a while, so I'm not going to be like, well, this was wrong from issue 7 and she should have said this. It's still its own thing enough that I enjoyed it.
The actress's name is Vivian Akimpong. I'm not able to pronounce it well. I vastly prefer this version of Lucien. For starters, I thought that the comic book Lucien looked too much like Kane, always, from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. They both had the same brown, wild hair, and the same skinny build and everything else. And I never had much interest in Lucien from the comics. I just found the character uninteresting. He didn't really have much to contribute. Where I liked how she is the person who was keeping up with Dreaming while he was away. She has sort of a mentor-mentee thing, but also she's clearly a subordinate because he's the ruler of the Dreaming, yeah. And she is one of the creatures that's supposed to help him to run the Dreaming. And so having that be a black woman and having her working for this white dude creates some interesting dynamics, but also the fact that in most of the things she says, she's right. She's on top of what's been going on. She didn't fuck off for 75 years or 100 years, whatever the math ends up being now.
Also, the other dreams come to realize that she's running the place.
Yeah. Well, and visually, she looks interesting. She doesn't look like any other character I can think of with mm-hmm. the bald hair, with the bald head, with the ears, with the glasses, with the suit and everything else. I can't think of another character in fiction that looks anything like Lucien from the show. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a really, we're going to talk about this later on. I think there are instances where they did race swaps where it does not work, and there are instances where it works very well. And I think this was an instance where the characters vastly improved with the casting, like the colorblind casting. Not just that, but again, like I said, I think that having a black woman in that role, in terms of like reflecting our world and reflecting power dynamics and stuff, is a lot more interesting and makes much more sense than having essentially like another Alfred for the Dreaming, like where they were in the comic books. So, but what else is going on in the comics though?
Oh, you keep asking, you got the comic. You goddamn man.
Well, yeah, but I want you to talk about it.
It has been over 20 years since I've read this. Yeah. Like,
well, one thing, like, it meant nothing to me when I read Preludes and Nocturnes the first time because I didn't know enough about DC's horror history. But one thing I found really interesting is they bring in The Witches 3 in a pretty pivotal moments in the TV show.
Yeah.
And I love how these were horror hosts. There was just like the Crypt Keeper, you know, from EC Comics stuff. You know, Cain and Abel were, of course, horror hosts as well. But because Cain and Abel had a lot to do throughout the DC universe. Like, I was a Blue Devil reader, and they were regular characters in Blue Devil because at one point he lived in the House of Mystery. And so seeing those characters wasn't a weird thing for me. Mm. You know, or I used to read Elvira's House of Mystery, and one of the themes was that the original housekeepers were gone, and Elvira had taken their place, and she was trying to find out what happened to the previous people. Not in depth. It was sort of like a subplot as she was introducing short stories and stuff. But those characters were visible enough to where I knew who they were. And again, Cain and Abel, if I remember correctly, might have been in that issue of Who's Who 2 that I got, that one issue. Where The Witches 3 meant nothing to me. I didn't know anything about them. But I love that he takes these horror hosts from a relatively short-lived 70s DC horror title and actually turns them into the Fates, mm-hmm. who are going to play a role throughout the Sandman series. They're toward the beginning of the series, and they're going to be there to the very end. And they're not necessarily active throughout most of that time period, but they are pivotal. And I just think it's really cool that they have them in the show and let you know that these are serious characters. These are characters are going to have a major role to play in terms of the overall narrative. So I thought that was really cool.
Because there's some stories they didn't even touch on, right? In the series.
What do you mean? Like the TV show?
Yeah.
No, that's one of the things that was so weird to me is I'm expecting liberties to be taken. And I think that Gaiman must have been gaming it this entire time to make sure that they were as true to the material as possible, or they managed to cultivate people who would be. Because, like, remember at one point Joel Silver had a version that was so terrible that Gaiman managed to, like, torpedo it. He basically, like, leaked stuff to the Hollywood Reporter or something that just tanked that version. And just a few years ago, Joseph Gordon-Levitt was trying to get a version of The Sandman into film, and then that one collapsed. So when it finally shows up at Netflix, he must have had some kind of major stake in this to get it to be as, like, almost just like faithful. Word for word, faithful. But they do make changes. Like, for instance, he introduces, over the course of The Sandman series, an antecedent to John Constantine, an ancestor, mm-hmm. I guess you could say, and Joanna Constantine. And, of course, the actual John Constantine character has already been adapted to film. film with Keanu Reeves. He already was adapted to an NBC. Yeah, he was already in an NBC TV show where they managed to somehow find some kind of rights loophole to get the same actor, the same character, to appear in DC's Legends of Tomorrow. And so that's still an active thing at the time that Netflix is producing the show. D-Cloud, of course, has been canceled since then. So they're like, well, we're not going to muddy that up. So we're just going to have Joanna Constantine. It's going to be women in both generations. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the same actress too, right?
I believe
Jenna
so.
Coleman from Doctor Who?
I think so.
That's an instance where I don't think it worked. John Constantine is such a singular, iconic presence. And so much of who he is in the comics is about his persona, his charisma, his cunning. That you have to have a really fucking sharp actor to play that character, or even a variation of that character. And with Jenna Coleman, they try to play up her being sassy and being like a sordid, and it just doesn't come across because she's too posh. She's just too clean, too proper. I don't buy her as being the kind of sordid character that John Constantine is, and she just seems kind of like a punk by comparison. I did not care for that casting, and also some of the tweaks they made to the story to accommodate her, I don't think that works. I really hated the bit where she does the exorcism on the member of the royal family that's running off with the demon guy and everything else. I thought all that was just kind of corny, and I realized they were trying to get away from the comics, but I felt like that was more comic booky than what they'd had in the actual comic books. What did you think about that, though?
It's fine, dude. I've read the one where his ancestors are women, and they are, you know, very similar, so it didn't bother me at all. She had her own miniseries, I believe, where she's like...
Well, the ancestor did, not the gender swap.
But I'm saying they just took that idea, that ancestor, and put her...
Is she Joan in the modern times?
I don't know.
It didn't make a huge impression.
I mean, I was fine with it. Again, this was their art, they're changing things. I mean, as long as they didn't do something stupid like, you know, Superman showed up, and like he never shows up in the books, and all of a sudden he showed up, I would have been like, okay, that's kind of weird. But I get it that he's trying to create his own universe because he can't use DC characters, so he's got to, you know, tweak
them. It was kind of a bummer, too, that when they take the trip through hell, when he's trying to reclaim his garments and everything, and he's trying to find out...
Lucifer was awesome.
Right, but you had Etrigan in the original comics where he was just some random demon in the show.
But you just said they didn't have rights to these characters, so they can't use them.
Well, I don't know. Has Etrigan ever appeared in anything in live action? Would that necessarily been an issue, you think?
Has he ever showed up? Well, because I think of, like Lucifer. The comic is basically a Sandman spinoff, is it not?
Right, and that's another instance where they do a gender swap too, where originally a male character and then they've gone to a female. But yeah, and Lucifer got adapted into a Fox TV show that I think they added an extra season on Netflix, right?
Yeah, season 6.
So it'd be kind of funny because you think you might want to mingle that up, but I guess they're the right
thing. He actually, whenever DC did that whole Venti verse where they were like all the shows were intertwining.
Oh, did they get him in there?
Yeah, yeah. There's a part where Constantine goes because he needs a favor, and they knock on the door, and it's Lucifer from the Fox show, and he's like, you again. And so I remember like that was kind of a wink, like, yeah we're all in the same universe, different Lucifer. So I mean, I was fine with it.
Well, I understand they can't make everything connect, and frankly I have no interest in that Lucifer TV show or that actor. I didn't really feel like that. Maybe the performance sells it, but just to look at him, he doesn't look like the one from the comics that much, and I've never really had an interest in watching that show.
I've seen all six.
Oh, you like it?
Yeah, seen all seasons. Love
how many seasons that one?
Six seasons
really?
Yeah, that was the
that's
big,
six seasons.
Yeah, that's the big
Holy
deal. That's
shit.
The big deal about the show being on Netflix to do a last season of six.
Okay, oh, because you had to get to six as Lucifer. Yeah. I get it. But I thought what's her name? I wanted to say Julia Christie, but that's the actress from the 70s.
Oh, great show though.
Gwendolyn Christie.
Okay.
Who's also in Wednesday, by the way. She's the headmistress on that show. I thought that was a good choice. I liked that since they were playing the dream character to appear to be very tall and lanky and everything else, having an actress as tall and as imposing, physically imposing as she is, was an interesting choice. I don't think you're ever going to beat wasn't Tilda Swinton Satan in one of the shows? Was she the Satan in...
Constantine.
She was?
Yeah, she was...
No,
she wasn't Lucifer. She was...
I thought Gavin Rossdale was Lucifer.
Yeah,
in
she was movie, she yeah. was like one of the archangels.
Okay. But she was like the villain, right?
Well, yes, because she is... Well, yeah, that's a whole other podcast, man.
Yeah. I feel like she's got that level of androgyny and just like... I mean, of course, she's an extraordinary actress. But I do think that she does a great job. It is interesting, though, that, again, they're wanting to make sure, I guess, in the long view, Lucifer is, of course, going to have a major role to play in the next season.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess having Morpheus fight a lesser demon wouldn't be as interesting for viewers, and it wouldn't tie as well into the next season as having Lucifer in that role.
Now, granted, I did find the battling kind of...
That was from the comics. My thing is this one problem with gender swapping Lucifer is for her to get beaten by Morpheus in this initial season kind of puts her on the defensive for the rest of the time.
Well, no, no.
And it's sort of like, it makes her, it diminishes a female character to be the person who gets defeated early on.
No, I think if anything, it just gold her even more to go to war. Because that was the whole thing. She needed him on her side so she could go to war with Heaven and start taking over the other kingdoms. Mm-hmm. And I think if anything, it just pissed her off even more.
Yeah.
Or pissed them off even more.
And then, of course, they're threading the Dr. Destiny story. What's the basics of his story in the show?
His mom...
Because it's David Thewlis.
Yeah. Mom got the necklace.
And his mom's the lady from Nip Tuck,
yeah. Yeah. But she got the stone to protect herself, to live forever. And then he's going batshit crazy.
Well, he's always been batshit crazy, yeah. Apparently.
And so she gives him the stone to protect him, which then, of course, kills her. But he's found a way to... But see, was somebody manipulating him?
The Corinthian. Because the Corinthian is involved in the story arc where he wasn't previously. And he's playing a long game of trying to stop himself from being destroyed by Morpheus after having had a chance to. It's kind of cute because they do something very similar to what they did with David Warner in Time After Time. Did you ever see that one?
No.
The one with Mary Steenburgen and Malcolm McDowell. Malcolm McDowell plays H.G. Wells, and he actually does invent a time machine, and it's stolen when it turns out that his buddy is actually Jack the Ripper, who's played by David Warner. And so David Warner travels through time. He comes to the 1970s or early 80s, and then H.G. Wells follows him to try to capture him and bring him back to his proper time. But what it turns out is when they meet up again, he's showing him, look, this is my world. You know, back in the 1800s, I was a freak who was running around killing people. People are getting killed all the time. There's the Son of Sam. There's the Zodiac Killer. There's all the other people. You know, well, these are all my children. You know, this is my time. You're the one who doesn't belong here. Why don't you just fuck off back to the Victorian era? This is where I belong. But he wants, of course, stop Jack the Ripper because he feels responsible for him getting away from after they'd like tracked him down. Like, I think they finally realized who he was and were going to come get him, but he disappears in time.
I hear a remake.
Yeah, and then they both get involved with Mary Steenburgen, who I think was a waitress and stuff. And
I hear a remake.
Yeah, it was a cool movie. I'm a fan.
Someone is a remake.
I can't believe you never saw that one. I think it had a heavy cable presence in the early 80s. So anyway, it's kind of like that with the Corinthian, where, you know, he sticks around when he was supposed to be eradicated by Morpheus back in the 1920s or late teens, like 1919 or so, right?
I think so.
And so he goes off and he becomes a serial killer and he inspires all these other serial killers, and it's kind of the same dynamic. It's like, no, I belong here. You're the one who doesn't belong here, right? But anyway, so they have him involved with the mother, who of course has a much bigger presence in the show than she ever had in the comics. I'm not sure if there is a mother in the comics, to be honest with you. I don't know they got into that stuff. I think it was just Dr. Destiny having the ruby because he was a supervillain.
Yeah, I think so.
I mean, they lock him up in an asylum and stuff. He's all deformed and such, but I don't think they got into his parentage or anything.
I just remember when he goes to the cafe and starts fucking with everybody's minds.
Right, right.
And they stayed pretty faithful to.
Well, and the one thing too, again, there's another instance with a race swap, is in the comics, it's just some random blonde woman that picks him up and gives him a ride. And of course, he looks all fucked up. So it's like, no one in their right mind would pick up a guy who looks like he looks in the comics.
Yeah.
But if you look like the Professor Lupin, then and he's running around in his slippers and a bathrobe and stuff, then he seems fairly harmless. But having a black woman in that role and having her slowly realize, oh, this guy's fucking insane and he's got a gun, he's a danger to me and everything else, I thought that was handled really well because, again, you've got these power dynamics her trying her best to get loose, and that's like a whole thing that they didn't have in the comic books, and how that does and doesn't work for her.
And then she gets the necklace, or doesn't
right,
she?
Right. Ultimately, she gives him the necklace, and that's another thing that's kind of cool. In the comics, he just shoots her, and it's just, you know, like, oh, super bitch got killed, ha ha ha. You know, it was a sour note in the comic. Where in the show, he gives her the necklace and sends her on her way, and she gets to live, and I think that's it gives him a little bit more depth, and that the relationship has way more depth on the show than it ever had the comic. So that's an instance where I think they made a major improvement on the show. But talk about the diner episode.
Oh, well, in the show, I mean, he's kind of what bringing out their dreams and their desires, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely him taking away inhibitions. And they show scale too, because you're seeing stuff happening on the TV. It's not just the diner. The diner is the microcosm, but the macrocosm is possibly throughout the world, but certainly through the general area. Everybody's becoming disinhibited and impulse driven and deluded and, you know, dangerous eventually. And so you're seeing these people like slowly come apart and all the weird stuff that he gets up to, because he's clearly fucked in the head. And this was also an instance where he's still, Gaiman's still trying to be a horror writer. Mm-hmm. He's still trying to do that Clive Barker type stuff. And I think eventually he realizes that's not who he is. It's like, it's what he's trying to be. I think he's probably seeing that as being commercially viable or something that where his interests lie at that time period. But I think the more he writes, the more he realizes he's not that writer. Mm-hmm. But I think that it's a pretty good horror story.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And I think that's where I got hooked, was the diner scene.
And then of course you have the confrontation between Morpheus and Dr. Destiny. I don't think they ever call him Dr. Destiny.
No.
They use his comic book alter ego name. And then that resolves. I'm wondering if people were kind of tripped out because it seems like the story arc has ended and therefore the series should end. You were pushing me to watch Doom Patrol as soon as possible. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons why I jumped off the show was I liked the initial story arc, and then they started doing tangents. They started doing the side missions, and that's when I started to lose interest because I just wanted them to find the chief. You know, that's the whole mystery they set up in the first episode. And then when we started doing the side shit, then I was like, oh man, come on, you know? And also, I thought they spent a little bit too much time in that alternate dimension. I got sort of tired of that.
Yeah.
So that's why I haven't gotten back to it, unfortunately. But one of the things that bugs me is they didn't resolve the first story, and then they're going into a whole second story in Doom Patrol. And I'm sure they did the whole story over the arc, but one of the things I really liked about The Sandman is they allowed, since they were being faithful to the comics, and they basically adapted the first story arc, the arc ends, and while they've laid seeds for continuations, it's very satisfying that, okay, this part of the story is over with, and now I can see what the next story is. So I thought that was handled well. And then, of course, that gets to the death episode, which was one I think a lot of people, myself included, were really looking forward to. I watched the show with Paquita, my girlfriend, and the good thing is, I think it's got a little high fantasy quotient to it, and she also likes horror as well. And so she immediately responded to the show. She also thought the guy playing Dreaming was hot, like totally her type. But there was like, I felt like, we both felt like the show hadn't quite gotten there yet. We were both interested in continuing. But I think that she was more invested once you got through the halfway point and once we got to the dream story. And I think that he says this in the introduction in the trade, but I think he's talked about it, if nothing else, that it was that issue, the one off story where they introduced death, where he finally figured out what the book was going to be and who he was as a writer and how he was going to progress from that point onward. It's a very well-known story, The Sound of Her Wings. By this point, Sam Keith is gone, blessedly. I think he left probably due maybe that the Aliens Earth War miniseries or something. And I think that was before he went off and did Marvel Comics Presents. And once he started doing Wolverine, that's when he was all of a sudden a hot artist.
Yeah.
And he had more complimentary inkers than Malcolm Jones III or Mike Gringenberg. But with this story, you've got Mike Gringenberg as the main artist. And I vastly prefer the artwork in this story over what had been previous. I think he was doing the last chapters of the first arc, but this fits really well. It's a fairly faithful adaptation on the television. They actually do it as a combo with another story that's later in the run. So what did you think about The Sound of Her Wings and the original story and the adaptation?
Yeah.
So here's one of the places where I have irritation is they've been very faithful to the visual of the Sandman, to Morpheus. And I think that visual, that goth thing, is important to the popularity of the character and the aesthetic of the character. And one thing I talked about with Domino and X-Force, because we never did the Deadpool 2 episode of Marvel Superheroes. I'm sure it'll come up when we eventually do all the last X-Men, Fox thing that I've talked about us doing, but we haven't done it yet. I had an issue with having a black actress and keeping the black leather. I didn't have a problem with casting a black actress in the role of Domino because while I haven't read a ton of Domino stuff, I read her first several years worth of appearances. And like I know Gail Simone did a spinoff series with her and got more involved with stuff. So maybe she got to be a more interesting character as she went forward. But in my experience, the most interesting thing about Domino was the visual. And so the whole thing is she's a person who's like an albino with a black spot and then black leather. So my feeling is if you're going to have a black actress in that role, you should do a negative. We'll have her in white leather. And so that contrasts against the black skin. And maybe she has like a white birthmark or something, and then you keep the visual aesthetic. Mm-hmm. Now, the difference is I thought that Domino in the movie was a way cooler character than I ever experienced in the comic book. I really enjoyed how she performed, and like ever since she played that part, I've seen Zazie Beetz and all this other stuff, and I always recognize her. I always be like, oh yeah, I know her, because she was so great in Deadpool 2. Mm-hmm. So then you get to death in The Sandman. And again, I think it's very important how she he's presented. Like, she's an albino. She looks like her brother. She dresses all in black, and yet she has that very cheerful, bubbly personality. My feeling is that she also has to have that little sister energy. So you really want like a Winona Ryder type, and you know, so and a more petite, like before she, you know, went fully on through puberty. I mean, you want somebody who's very small and very petite and has that little sister, like that bubbly little sister quality. And the problem I have with the actress they got is she's very womanly. You know, she's they're dressing her all in black, but she also still has her brown skin. She looks nothing like the person who's supposed to be her brother. So they didn't do the whole negative thing. But also, her vibe isn't right for that character. I feel like she's too much. She's an older sister, and as presented in the show, she seems like she's more mature, more sophisticated. She doesn't really have that bubbliness. She has a gentility to her. She has a sweetness about how she interacts with the people that she's claiming to take to the afterlife. But you don't have that bubbliness. You don't have that contrast of having this Grim Reaper who's like real sweet and light and stuff. Like, we just finished watching the Guardians of the Galaxy Christmas special, and like Pom Clemente as Mantis feels more like Death to me than the actress they got for the show. So that's a sticking point for me. I think that's an instance where they did a race swap where it doesn't work visually, and I don't think the actor completely pulls it off. I think the episode is great. I literally, while I'm watching the episode, I started to kind of choke up, especially when she goes for the baby.
Yeah.
You know, it choked me up. The episode was effective, but I don't credit her with that. I feel like it was the story that was pushing me forward, and then the atmosphere of that story, but I don't think the actress sold the character very well for me.
So I will disagree.
Okay.
I like the fact that she seemed older, because in my mind, Death would be older than Dreams. Like, she would have been born first. Like, there'd be life, death, before there'd be dreams and desire and...
Well, see, I'm not sure. I think they do talk about that, and she might be older than him, but I'm saying the vibe is sister comics.
I like the fact that she's more stoked. He's emo, dude. So he's always whiny and bitchy and just, oh, no one understands me. Where she's just like, I am a force. Like, I take away what someone else gave you. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's nothing bad. You didn't lose anything. I'm just a reaction to an action. I kind of like that. I like the fact that she was very like, I like when Death is kind of not so much nonchalant, but there's almost like a poetry to it. It's like, oh no, it's just the next page.
Mm-hmm.
Where I like the fact that Dream can't relate to the humans because he's only in their dreams. He only sees what they dream about. He doesn't know who they really are. He sees their fantasies. So I kind of like that about her, where she's trying to teach him, like, you know, you idiot, you don't understand them because you're only in their dream. Which of course led us to the one of the cooler stories is where he finally decides to befriend a human.
Right, the Hobgadley.
Yeah,
yes.
It, which was one of my favorite stories.
Oh yeah, that one too. Okay. Yeah. So that was in the Doll's House. That's right, because that was one of those weird ones where
it just came out of nowhere in the book.
Exactly. It's like it's one of those situations where obviously the artist was running late, and instead of letting the book just drag on indefinitely, that was back in the old days when we gotta kind of get a comic book out this month, and so they have an entirely different story that has nothing to do
like a filler issue.
Yeah, but obviously they made good use out of it because
it's
such
a great concept. It's a great concept where you're keeping a human alive and you're seeing him, his highs and lows, but he loves life. And so I was really happy they had that story in there.
I know that's one. Paquita loved that one. She thought that was really cool. I think she liked the whole thing where Morpheus is, this is like a bet with him. It's like a thing he's doing with his sister. It's got nothing to do with the human. And then when the human has the audacy to think that he's a friend, and then ultimately they do become friends.
Well, he tells him,
she loved that.
Yeah, I really
she really got into the whole I don't need any friends, and it's like, oh yeah, I do need a friend, I got a friend. Oh.
But see, that to me is Death showing him how to relate to whose world he lives. Because let's be honest, is it really Dream's world, or is it our world and he's just a caretaker of our dream?
Yeah, well, that's something they talked about a little bit on the show, and certainly in the comic books, is like who's the master and who's the servant, kind of, sort of, you know?
Who made who?
Yeah, who made you? Yeah. Okay, so one of the things that's an interesting choice is they bring the Hobgoblin story up, because again they do adapt the Doll's House, but you know, this is much later.
I think they took a shot because they're like, we might not get a season two, so let's just take some cool parts of the
book. But it also makes more sense though, because Death is in both stories too, and both, you know, and they do both reflect, you know, life and death. So it makes sense thematically with what they're addressing, is her trying to explain to him, you know, there's more to life than the role that you've got to play, and you know it worked. But in doing that, they drop a story that takes place immediately after that in the comic book, and because they allude to it in a way that they didn't in the comic books in the first season, and they're going to address that character more fully in the second season, I thought that was probably the right play. I think that the story is going to work better at the beginning of season two than it would have in the middle of season one. So I think they made some smart choices as far as where to move the stories around to make it make more sense as an entire season.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they missed that whole part with the African.
Yeah.
But they did allude to it whenever he's going to hell and she sees him. So they allude to it a little bit, but they didn't give it a full.
It was smart. They tease it so that it's part of the first season. People know this is something that's going to be addressed later on.
But that was more, I think that was more wink to the fans.
Like, yeah, hey, absolutely.
Like here.
Well, but also thematically, it helps us set up the second season.
True.
You know, so that's good. So then we actually get into the doll's house and we start getting introduced to more members. I mean, obviously, you got Death, but you get more of a rapid succession of members being unveiled there. And of course the story starts in Desire's domain, which is a gigantic human body and a gigantic representation of themselves.
Looked great. I thought it looked great. Looked great.
Yeah, and of course we also get Despair introduced there as well, and Despair is another one that says, now again, and like I said, what with Death, in a lot of her early appearances they actually gave her a Caucasian flesh tone, and that never worked for me either. It always threw me off. It's like, what are you doing? That doesn't look right. That's not what's on the t-shirts, right? And then most members of the Endless are also white and with dark hair, and in fact at one point there was the theory that Lobo was a member of the Endless. I don't remember.
I didn't hear about that. But that makes sense, he can't die.
Right. But again, they're doing sort of like race blind, color blind casting. What did you think about the actor portraying Desire?
I thought it was great.
Oh yeah?
I thought they were great, yeah.
And see, I don't know their preferences, I don't know their pronouns.
I thought it was Alan Cumming for a second.
There was a big Alan Cumming vibe, but one issue that I have again is, to me, the this is a character that presents to me as a gay man. It looks like a man.
No, it's supposed to be.
Well, no, I know what it's supposed to be, but one of the issues I'm having is that I'm looking at the character and the androgyny, I think, is supposed to be an important part of the character.
Yeah.
You're not supposed to know whether it's a male or a female.
I could tell. I thought it was Lady Gaga for one moment, then I thought it was Alan Cumming the next. I was
Okay, yeah. So my problem is
I got some very Lady Gaga vibes one minute, and I got some very Alan Cumming. So that's why I was like, first, when I first heard the voice and I saw the lips, I'm like, hey, that's Alan Cumming. Then I saw the eyes, and I'm like, well, no, is that Lady Gaga? Like, so I
picked up masculine presence there, and I didn't feel the androgyny. And for me, since there's a key
point, Bowie,
or Tilda Swinton, or like somebody like the actor from The Crying Game, somebody where you don't
had Lucifer, where you can't really, you could go either way with her sexes.
I thought that I thought she was clearly feminine.
No, she definitely played worse. The short hair, you definitely were like, is it like, it's an angel,
yeah,
so it's male female. It's, I definitely got that from Lucifer. Dream definitely was a guy. Despair definitely a girl.
Yeah, and I really didn't like that casting because that was just like a chick in, you know, who looks like a suburban house mom or something. I realized that they probably didn't want to have a completely nude woman wandering around the series, yeah, because it seems like they skirt our stuff in the show, but really it feels like they land in a more like hard PG-13 place. And so I guess having a fully nude woman as an ongoing character, they probably had some issues with, especially if there's full frontal nudity potentially.
Yeah.
But I think that's a character that you could have potentially race swapped and it wouldn't have been a problem, because I don't think that anybody was a huge Despair fan to begin with. But especially just having a white chick dressed like a housefrau, that couldn't have, there isn't a more boring way you could have approached that.
See, I thought you would have been complaining like they gave Patton Oswalt too much.
Oh God, yes. Okay, yeah, that is an issue for me too.
See,
Patton Oswalt, you do not have to be in all the things. Yeah, I forgot about Matthew.
The thing is,
because we're going through the book, and Matthew hasn't been introduced.
Everything you've bitched about so far, I'm like, okay, that's really weird. Like, well, it's not Harajana. Okay, that's really weird to me because I didn't see that coming. I was really expecting like Patton Oswalt. I thought we were gonna talk an hour about you bitching about Patton Oswalt as the fucking crow.
Oh yeah, no.
Raven, whatever.
You can say no, Patton. I'm sure that you're financially secure enough. At some point, you can say no to a comic.
I really thought we were gonna do an hour podcast of you bitching about that. Not everywhere else you've gone. So I was a little caught off guard right now.
Right. Well, my thing, okay, look, the problem I'm having is that ultimately I think he actually is a good choice for the voice. It's like when I first heard the voice, I'm like, fuck, Patton Oswalt again.
When he did Happy, he was perfect as the imaginary character in Happy. You saw Happy?
No, I did not.
Oh, fuck you, man. Like, what's wrong with you?
Well, it was on sci-fi, dude.
No, dude, it's literally on fucking Hulu.
It was on sci-fi originally.
Yeah, well, no, but it's
on Hulu. I didn't read the comics. I didn't read that series.
It's one trade.
I didn't read it.
Well, the second season sucks. Don't even watch it. Yeah. But the first season.
I'm not watching the first season. What are you talking about?
Oh, no. The first season is great. It follows the book. It's Patton Oswalt as an imaginary.
Yeah.
Yeah. But Patton Oswalt as an imaginary unicorn flying was great. So when I heard him as the Raven, I'm like, oh, okay. Like, he can pull this off because you need a little snarkiness. You need a bit of a little sass. Perfect. So I was like, I was fine with it.
Yeah. See,
but I knew as soon as. I was like, oh, Frank's going to bitch about this already.
It was just like, he does all this shit.
He's doing a lot of heavy lifting, dude. There's a lot of fucking, like,
Blade Trinity, Happy, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
What's his name? Fuck, I can't believe I forgot his name. Firefly.
Oh, yeah.
The main actor.
Mel.
What's his name? Why can't I think of his name right now? We just saw him in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yeah. No, he wasn't in that, was he?
Remember? He's one of the prisoners. He's one of James Gunn's closest friends.
Yeah.
Where he's like, I'm going to slather you in the jelly. He's that monster. Why can't I think of the actor's fucking name? Well, never mind. It just ruined it now. Because he's supposed to be like the king of nerds. And Patton Oswalt is the prince of nerd.
He's hidden enough shit. Plus, you know.
He's done tons of sci-fi, and
they cast the guy from Black Manta. He's going to be Simon Williams, Wonder Man, in the MCU. So that was going to be his part. He's going to try to be Simon Williams. And from the deleted scenes from Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 2, and now he's just a random character in that show. He's not going to be anything major because they've recast that part since he ended up on the cutting room floor.
Okay. Well, anyway,
the point is, I don't think he's nearly, because he's done plenty of mainstream shit. He was on that Rookie or what it was, the one about the writer and shit. So I don't. Like, Patton Oswalt is in all the geek shit. I don't think there's any competition with those two. My thing is, I don't want to deal with him as Pip. That's the line I'm drawing. It's like, I really don't want him to play that character.
I couldn't care less.
Ultimately, he was so good as Matthew that I couldn't fault him. So it's like, at first I was like, dude, I'm tired of you. But he won me over because he really is a good choice, I feel like. The only problem is, since he's a reincarnation of Matt Cable from the Bernie Wrightson and Lynn Wein Swamp Thing comics, there's no way I'm going to believe Patton Oswalt as that character who becomes Matthew. Mm-hmm. But because of how Matthew's portrayed in the series and his persona as the Raven, it's like, okay, well, yeah, he's kind of perfect for that. He's a good fit. And of course, they play up the Raven earlier on in the series because they don't introduce him to my recollection until the Doll's House. But they've got a Raven from the very beginning.
Yeah, he's visiting Dream in the glass cage, which he never did in the book. Remember where they're going around trying to shoot him in the house and shit?
Yeah. And then you start the story of Rose Walker. And this is another instance where I thought they made a really good choice in changing out actors. Because in the original comics, it's a mother and daughter, and they're both a couple white chicks. And I never gave a shit about Rose Walker in the comics. I found the character to be kind of bland. I thought she was just a cipher that kind of gets the story across. And she's a damsel in distress by the end of it. I just don't think that there was much there. And certainly her relationship with her mom, you know, it was kind of boring, very like basic, basically, my reckoning. So what they do in the TV show is they cast a black actress in the role of Rose Walker. They kill off the mom. And so, and of course, the dad's also dead too. So she's got a brother in the world that she loves and she's trying to track him down. But because she is just barely of age, I think she's supposed to be like 18 or so, right? Yeah. And then her brother is still underage, and the brother's already with a foster home, if not an adoptive home. Mm-hmm. There's all these precautions to make sure that those two can't reconnect, especially because there was already fucked up family situations that helped to separate them in the first place. And so by orphaning her and making her desperate to try to find this brother, who's like at the beginning of the story, the only family member she knows about, and she's afraid for his safety and afraid for her circumstances, and she just wants to be reconnected with the one blood relative that she knows of, that she loves and has a relationship with. I thought that invested me much more in the character than I did in the comic books. But they also did the clever bit where they introduce Lita Hall. I don't know if she's actually called Hall, but she's the character from Infinity Incorporated who is married to the son of Hawkman, who was killed when he took on a second role. He was originally the Silver Scarab, who was sort of a riff on Blue Beetle before DC owned the rights to Blue Beetle. And then they turned him into a version of the Sandman from the 1970s, the Kirby Sandman. And then he got killed off. And in the Infinity Inc. series, they had this weird thing where they were both like lost in the dream dimension. It was a tying into that 70s series. And so Neil Gaiman Gaiman wanting to have the Sandman, kind of the point of Preludes and Nocturnes, was him to go around and kind of do his own version of Armor Wars, but with dreams. Where he's like establishing, okay, yeah, I have a connection to the Sandman from the 1940s, but that guy's dead and he doesn't matter anymore. And then I've got a connection to the version from the 70s, but I'm going to take care of this as part of my initial story arc with, you know, having this guy who stole his possessions and was running around doing something he wasn't supposed to do. That was interesting. But in order to avoid all the bullshit with Infinity Inc. and still get the character involved in the story, they just make her the companion that goes with Rose to England when they're given plane tickets to for some, you know, mission unknown, essentially. Yeah. And ultimately, it turns out that her grandmother had been one of the people afflicted with the sleeping sickness. And she'd only just woken up once Morpheus was freed.
Yeah.
And she's trying to reconnect with her family. So you have these
complimentary narratives. She had a baby while she was asleep.
Exactly. And that was her mother, the mother who's now dead. And so you've got this situation where she's also believed to be an orphan, believed to have lost all of her family, and she's trying to reconnect with the one person that she could find that's a blood relative as well, that's family, a person who's, you know, she went to sleep one day and she wakes up and everybody's dead and she's an old lady. So they both are kind of on the same mission, but of course they're coming at it from two different extremes, and of course they both need one another, and they but at the same time they also are both desperate to find this third member of the family. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also really interesting, you got this rich old lady who is African, you know, it's of English, African English, I don't know how you would say it, but it's almost like a more of a fairy tale in that situation. Like for the white chicks to run into the rich relative, you know, that's one thing, but for an African-American woman to have this rich relative in this foreign land and helping her to get to her brother and all this kind of stuff, it has a fantastical quality to it that I think is very attractive. I think it's much more interesting story with the actor that they chose.
Now, what did you think about Rose dealing with her roommates?
That was interesting too, because again, in the comics, she's just sort of like kind of the flaky chick who's got the goofy hair and stuff. Yeah. Where with her, it's a greater sense of she's a person who's trying to navigate a society where she's lost everybody that means anything to her. And obviously because she's got all the weird dyed hair and stuff, she's probably a little bit of a goofball as well. So she ends up with these misfits that are all supporting each other. And I think that they developed those characters well. I thought the characters were always interesting, especially once they showed the fracturing of the dreams and stuff. Mm-hmm. There's always an interesting selection of characters. But when they get fucking Hedwig, you know, I think it's more impactful because, like, this is a person who's bringing their baggage into the show, mm-hmm. but it's the good baggage. It's like he's not just some random guy who happens to do drag and is gay. It's a guy who literally, that was his profession and the source of his great fame, and became a movie director and then directed Broadway and all this kind of stuff. Doing the person who got to do the thing that his character never gets to realize in the show. The casting brings something to the show from outside the show that has value to it. So I thought that was...
Because I always loved Stephen Fry.
The one issue I did have...
Don't tell me Stephen Fry.
Which one was Stephen Fry?
Green.
Oh, yeah, he's great. Yeah, no, I got... Fiddler's Green was perfect, man. Yeah. He just like... He walked right out of the comic books. That was perfect. No problem there.
Because I was like,
I'm not going after him. He was perfect. Absolutely perfect. The only one I did not care for was Barbie.
Yeah, that one...
I just didn't feel like that was the right actress. She didn't have the right... Because you want to have that... Well, both Ken and Barbie.
Yeah.
You want to have them be the plastic people, the yuppies. Yeah. And you also want to believe her when she becomes the fairy character in her dreams. But she just seems... I don't know. She just seems... And too much like she's from a sitcom instead of like this fantasy series.
Yeah.
I just didn't think it worked very well.
I like
and of course that character is going to have to change. You know, she's going to change dramatically by the time we get to A Game of You. And that character didn't have much of an impact on me when I read the Doll's House initially.
Mm-hmm.
But I really didn't care for that actress. I didn't care for either of the actors in those roles. But everybody else I thought was quite good in the house. But especially Fiddler's Green was excellent.
Yeah.
But what do I know him from? I know his face, but I don't know by name.
Dude, he's a huge British comedian. I mean, he's done. He was in V for Vendetta. I'm sure he was probably in Harry Potter. They were all in fucking Harry Potter. Actually, was he in Harry Potter? I don't know. No, I think
all of them got in there some way, so probably.
But I know Stephen Fry does like a lot of comedy. I'm just trying to think. He did the actor that plays Mr. Bean.
Oh yeah, Rowan Atkinson.
Yeah, I think he did some stuff with him. But yeah, that's an actor I know from way back.
Yeah, and this was also a situation too where also the role of her brother, the abused kid, the foster kid that's just been taken in to get money from the state and stuff. Having that be an African American American kid and having the appearance be white people who don't see him as fully human and treat him as something subhuman adds layers of that story that weren't there initially. And I thought that worked really well. But also the kid's a pretty good actor. And yeah. I like the whole thing where
trying to sneak they
got him into the costume.
Yeah.
And if you look on his monitor screens, they actually do have DC characters on the monitor screens when they go into the dream
world. Oh, really? I didn't know that.
And I thought it was interesting too, where they had, instead of it being, you know, Blue Root and Glob, they have a nightmare that's more fully realized as a character. And also, again, having her be an African woman mm-hmm. and having her be a mother figure to him.
She wants to be a dream.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And she's doing the wrong thing for the right reasons. Mm-hmm. Again, all those characters have a lot more nuance, a lot more depth because of the choices they made on that show. I thought that was really well done.
I think Corinthian was really the only bad guy.
The proper villain. Yeah. Right, right. Well, I mean, in Doctor Destiny, okay, look, Boyd Holbrook. The one thing with Corinthian, he probably was supposed to be American. In rereading the story, I think they allude to him being American because there's something distinctly American about serial killers, even though, again, I'm Jack the Ripper. Yeah. You know, that's very English. But it still threw me a little bit to have that Southern drawl in a character that has that kind of Bowie quality that the Corinthian has. So that threw me off. But I do have to say that I think Boyd Holbrook, and one of the reasons why I remember his name is because that sounds like such a fake name. I don't want to know if it's his real name or not. It sounds like somebody who's like, what's a good name for an actor on a TV show? Boyd Holbrook. But you know, he was really good in Logan, and he does a pretty damn good job as a Corinthian too. And you do have that kind of contrast where you have the rather goth, you know, Morpheus, and then the more Southern American. You have that power dynamic there that's interesting too, because it's almost like he's the rebel who's fighting for his freedom, his state rights, you know, whatever the hell.
So real quick, I always get him mixed up with the actor that played Rick Flag.
I can see that. I've done that too.
I thought for a minute, I'm like, hey, it's Rick Flag. But the other thing is, at one point, I just wish, and I wanted it where they would show him maybe having a conversation with someone, but his mouth wasn't moving.
Oh, yeah.
And you knew his eyes were speaking.
Yeah.
Because I remember when I watched it, I was like, oh, I thought it looked great visual. Uh-huh. And I remember like, oh, it would have been so amazing if like there was a third voice.
Yeah.
And it turns out it's the eye speaking. Right. And I would have been like, oh, that would have been so great.
And they did downplay the eyes a little bit. I kind of wish they'd done a little bit more with the eyes to sell the creepiness of that more.
Oh, it was already fucking creepy.
But it was a little subdued, I thought.
Yeah, I mean, like I said,
now, what did you think about the serial killers, though? Because one of the big things... one of the big things was Neil Gaiman thought of the idea. He's at a comic convention. He's seeing all these people that are comic book fans. And probably some of them are a little bit creepy and a little socially awkward and stuff. And he had the flash of, what if this, instead of was a comic book convention, what if it was a serial killer convention? And it's just like any other convention. These are all...
Well, they kept calling it a serial convention, right?
Right, right. That was the joke, is that it was supposed to be like
serial.
Why don't they have any boxes around, you know?
Yeah.
But I think I've always thought that was a brilliant idea. And especially if you're a creator on the one side of the table and you've got all you weirdos coming at you from the other side, it makes sense you would do that. I thought they did a really good job with the serial killers they cast on the show too. You know, I bought all of them. And I thought they all had their own really well.
They all look up to the Corinthian. He's like the goat. I always thought that he got that idea because I remember reading an article where Alan Moore used to have nightmares of conventions.
Mm-hmm.
And he said like they would all track him down and like kill him. So I was like, I don't know.
Yeah. Now there's some stuff I don't think translated. Like you got that great 9-panel grid about the guy who's talking about how he held the guilt about masturbating. And so when he got done with a porno magazine, he'd rip the magazine to pieces. And then when he moved on to women, when he got done with him, he'd rip them to pieces too and shit. Mm-hmm. And having that as a 9-panel grid of his face, it all kind of fractured and stuff. I think comic books could potentially be creepier. Usually it's the other way around. Usually a movie, the immediacy of it, the greater senses being engaged is scarier than a comic book. But I think this is an instance because of the nature of the comic book and the creepiness of Mike Gruenberg's artwork. I think the comic is more effectively a horror story than the show was. Mm-hmm. I don't think it ever, the show has a little bit of a gloss to it. It's got that Netflix sheen to it. I don't think you ever fully feel the threat of the environment on the show the way you felt in the comic book. Because the comic books, I think, is more immersive. And I think that literary quality too, creative exaggeration made it more harrowing in the comic book.
I thought about this a little bit before we recorded.
Mm-hmm.
I feel that maybe the reason they did so much in season one was because they looked at what happened to like fucking Millar's shit, where like only one season and they didn't even finish it out, correct?
I never watched Jupiter's Circle. Jupiter's... What was it called?
I don't know, Jupiter something. But I think they were concerned that they had another instance like that on their hands and they were worried, hey, we don't want to get stuck with something that we can't at least have a finish or at least wrap it up so that that we can say, hey, at least we have a season of it. So I don't think they got to be as artistic as they would have with the comic book. They were just trying to get the story on screen and fingers crossed.
But there's also certain demands that Netflix makes about how movies are shot and how they're lit and the definition.
Dude, have you seen their new fucking, like, was it 1877 where it's like almost all black and white on a ship and it's the Bermuda Triangle and all that shit?
No.
Oh, yeah. It just came out this week.
Okay, so but they get away from that is what you're telling
me. I think they let the artists do their art, but let's be honest, Sandman was a huge gamble.
Mm-hmm.
It was a huge gamble.
And that was not a cheap show. That was a very expensive show. That's so, one of the things that they were talking about. It's like, it was so expensive and Netflix have gotten so cheap and where they're actually canceling shows that were already in production and shit, that there was some question about them coming back. Now, Gaiman always was kind of cagey about that, but said, don't worry, no matter what happens, we're going to get a second season. I think there's some kind of deal where they're going to lose the show if they don't do a second season. And so
it's going to like Amazon would have picked up in a heartbeat. Amazon would have picked up in a heartbeat.
I got to say, of all the streamers, I think Prime's comic book adaptation game is probably the best. I think they've had some of the best adaptations, especially given that they're not, you know, it's
they threw a lot of money at that Tolkien shit. That was kind of
some people seem to like that one, but I'm talking about comic book adaptation. Like stuff what? Like Invincible and The Boys
let's be honest. Invincible animation, super easy. The Boys, dude, he has 8 fucking trades.
Yeah,
and let's be honest, they went boyish.
Okay,
they didn't go full boys.
Okay,
they went fucking full boys. That shit would have an X.
But you still think it's a great show, though?
Yes, I enjoy it. Is it The Boys? No.
Okay,
I don't. I watch it. I watch it like this.
Yeah,
you can watch Deadpool rated R and like fucking all Deadpool's greatness, mm-hmm. or I can watch X-Men 96 on Disney Plus, and it's still the same universe, same feel, but one is definitely Disney and the other one is definitely not Disney.
Yeah.
When I watch The Boys, what I read is fucking X-rated, like Herogasm, when they're like, you need to watch Herogasm, and I'm watching, I'm like, that's it? Like,
right.
Jesus Christ, like the first 3 pages of Herogasm was fucking way worse than this.
Yeah.
But they got a little darker. I do enjoy it. Actually, I really, really do enjoy it. I own the first 2 seasons. I really, really do enjoy it. I've rewatched the seasons. I think Butcher's great. I think Huey's great. I do hate, I know this turned into a whole different other fucking podcast now, but yeah. I do
brief
hate,
tangent.
Give I do hate road. I do hate the fact that I feel like they I hated the fact that they changed Mother Milk's origins.
Okay.
I really fucking hate that. I love the fact that his mom is this giant mutant in the basement and he has to go suckle her breast to drink her milk to keep his powers. I hate that the Frenchman is so fucking weak.
Okay, well, don't list all your issues with a show that we're announcing spoiling the Sandman.
Don't give a shit.
We're not fucking spoiling The Boys. The Boys.
Welcome to Mr. Fix-It Show,
as a Wildstorm DC title, but they're no longer DC.
This was just for Mac because he's always bitching that I spoil shit. That's right, Mac. You should have watched before you listened to the asshole.
Actually, didn't he watch The Boys already?
I don't know. Probably not. He's probably like, oh, I've just finished episode 3. He's ruined the series for me. I can never watch it again.
Okay.
So
I wanted to make sure to name check the actress. Kaio Ra, it looks to be the name, who plays Rose Walker. I think she's probably the best actor on the show.
That's a tall order.
No. I think that she has such an incredible positive energy and imbues a character that was like nothing to me on the page with so much life, so much vitality. I really grew to love that character as portrayed by that actress. And I was just extremely impressed at how much she got to do and how much I believed her as being this powerful being who was a danger to the universe and everything, but yet somebody that I'm still rooting for. Instead of like, I'm usually pretty like, oh, you're a threat to the all of reality. Well, cut that bitch, you know, kill that bitch. Where with her, I liked her so much, I didn't want anything to happen to her. And so that made the ending of the season much better for me. The big resolution and bringing all the other characters and setting up what's going to happen later seasons. And of course, especially by making Leta Hall such an important part of the last few episodes, sets up how important she's going to be over the course of the series as well. And I like that actress. And that was an instance where I think that the gender swap, or not the gender swap, the race swap was neutral. It's like, I think it was more interesting to have her it not be a white chick, but it wasn't anything that like made it, didn't make it really make a major change either.
So. Okay. My take, I hope she's not in season 2.
Oh, you don't like
care.
Her?
Don't care. No, you're a fine actress. Yeah. I like that she mixed in with the misfits and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Don't care. It's Sandman.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see Sandman's adventures.
Right.
She had her little adventure. I sat through her with season 1. She's fine. Great actress. I enjoyed her.
Wait. Are you talking about Rose Walker?
Yeah, the whole character.
I thought you were talking about
The actress was fine. Okay.
She didn't come back anyway, does she? I mean, maybe she does a little something in the game for you.
Don't want to hear it. Okay. I want Sandman to go forward. I want Lucifer to go after him.
Yeah.
I
don't think Rose Walker is part of the major part of the rest of the series.
She was fine. I mean,
it's Leta or Lida. I don't remember how you pronounce it, but they planted a seed for her that's going to be extremely important by the end of the series.
Okay.
She's going to be essential to the end of the series, so it gives an opportunity opportunity to bookend it. But the Rose Walker character, while I think she does appear like a couple more times, it's Mika Pete, though. She's not going to be a major part of the show again unless they radically alter the narrative, which all indications are that's not going to be the case.
Okay, because I think the
most alterations we're going to see on the show was the first season because of how many ties they had to the DC universe in those early issues.
I think, if anything, she was just used to push the story forward, and I'm fine with that. But I really want to see more of the other fates and all that. I want to see all that. I don't want another human that's the fucking linchpin to the universe. Yeah. And,
well, again, you didn't make this far based on what you told me, but the Barbie character is going to have a major arc probably in the next season.
Okay.
Maybe, you know what? Probably not. It's probably not going to be until season three. Because they more or less got through 16 or so issues of the series in adaptation. So they do that again. They would the second season would get them to the end of Season of Mists, but not into the other stories like Distant Windows or A Game of You.
Or do you think maybe Game is just like, no, I just want two seasons and I'm going to wrap up the universe in two
seasons? No. I think he wants this whole thing adapted. I think he's trying to do everything he can to make sure that it gets through the whole series.
Can they get that far, though?
I mean, the ratings are pretty good on the same. The problem is it's expensive. And I would think that the second season would be more expensive than the first season. So I'm not sure about if it's cost effective, but it was a very popular global hit. I don't think it's done the numbers of some of the other big shows because I read it's not Squid Game or anything yet, but it's done quite well. It's done better than it's not posting Stranger Things 4 numbers. Stranger Things took a while to build up too. I mean, it was a hit initially.
No, it was but a huge hit when it first came out.
It was a big hit, but it didn't do
well. So to give you an idea,
yeah.
I remember watching Sandman and not hearing anything about it at work. Wednesday came out and I was already hearing that shit at work.
Okay.
So
yeah.
I don't know. And I mean, I'm going to watch
more. I heard more about the Sandman in general than I heard, like, say, Peacemaker, for instance. But also, I think Peacemaker's probably not as expensive a show as the Sandman appears to be.
Well, but Peacemaker was also kind of fucking weird. That's very James
Gunn-centric. Right.
I mean, I don't know. I know some people who started and didn't finish it because they were like, oh, it's the DC Universe. And then they watched it and you got fucking, you know, Vigilante doing other words. And they're just like, eh, and they tuned out.
Yeah.
I felt Peacemaker was more
niche.
Well, fan base. Like, that's for us who are in the comics.
I think there's some reasonable expectation that you're going to have to get a new audience with Sandman. You're not just getting fans. That's
what I'm saying. Sandman is like if they were filming a fucking Shakespearean, you know, Midnight Dreams type. It's very Shakespearean, so you can kind of get away where it's like, it's intellectual. It's not, you know, some dude in his tidy whities with a fucking helmet.
Right.
So like, oh, okay.
Banging a random chicken.
Yeah, so I can see where people, because like I said, I did hear some people ask me about, like I had a friend at work ask me about Sandman. They're like, have you ever read Sandman? I'm like, yeah, I read Sandman. Is it any good? I'm like, yeah, you like it. But they also like Lord of the Rings and stuff.
Right.
And I told them, oh yeah, you'll be fine. Because I remember they asked. Now I thought it was weird. Now this person that I'm speaking of doesn't read comic books, but they like Lord of the Rings movies. They like Game of Thrones stuff. So I was kind of like, yeah, you'll be fine. It's kind of in the same vein.
Yeah. And then the bonus episode, A Dream of Cats.
Didn't see it.
You didn't watch the bonus
episode? I didn't know about it.
Okay.
And so we talked about this. And so now I heard about it, but I haven't watched it yet.
When did you hear about it?
Not too long ago. I watched the series and then just left it alone.
Right. And then you didn't know they had a bonus episode.
So I heard bonus material.
No, it's a full episode.
I heard bonus material. So I'm like, well, what the fuck do I want to watch bonus material? So I never went back. And then when you were talking about recording this, I was like, all right. And I went in there and I'm like, wait, what the fuck is this about cats? I'm like, ah, shit. So I just haven't watched it yet.
Full
episode?
It's a full episode. Well, it's actually, okay, it's two parts. Is that they adapt A Dream of Cats for the first half, and that one's fully animated. And it's a really interesting animated style because in the original comics, it was drawn by Kelly Jones.
Okay.
Who's extremely stylized. And so if they were going to literally adapt his artwork, that would have been extremely interesting, but they didn't do that. They did something that was like this weird sort of hybrid. It's like kind of CGI, but also kind of animation. I thought it was really interesting, and they did some fun stuff with it. Like, they did have some of the nudity in that one, for instance. And it was quite cute. I know a lot of people seem to really like it. And it's one of the favorite stories of a lot of people from the comics. But also, I don't think it's all that as a story. Mm-hmm. And, like, Paquita, she hated it. She thought it was stupid. She thought it was corny.
She liked animals?
No, but she's not an animal person. She's not a cat person. So, yeah, that kind of... I see what you're doing there.
Why do you think she didn't like it then?
Yeah. And they did another adaptation, too. I'm trying to remember which one they adapted, the second one.
So it's two stories?
Yeah, because again, it's a full episode. And so the first half is the animated cat story, and the second half... Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's from way later. That's the one where the guy has a muse who's locked up in his... Like, he...
Okay, yeah, ruiner.
Sorry. Well, the story Richard was in the original comics. Yeah, okay. Again, it's an adaptation. Basically, he's a writer who's sort of washed up. He had one big hit book, and he's blocked, and he can't get the second book, and he's overextended, and he's all out of money, and the publisher's, you know,
breathing down
his neck. And he meets up with another author who is a much more kind of scummier guy. And basically, it turns out that he has a muse. And because he's going to be dying sooner rather than later, he basically is tired of his muse and is willing to offload her to this guy. And it's how he responds to having this muse available to him. And that was a live action story. And I thought that one was all right. I thought they did a pretty decent job with that one too. Reasonably well cast. It just wasn't nearly as strong as the animated one with the cat, I thought. But they were both interesting stories. And I want to see the one-offs. They made a point of almost everything from the first season connecting to everything else and having it be one uber arc instead of having the little one-off stories. Because like the Hobgoblin, as it was presented in the comic books, it was a one-off.
Yeah.
But they incorporated it into the story in the
growth,
TV show. Yeah. Right. So I was afraid that they were going to feel the need to do that all the time and maybe not do the one-off stories. And I think some of the best Sandman stuff is the Dunnan ones. So it was really nice to have that little, like, you know, here's a bonus.
Yeah.
And I assume that maybe the animation wasn't ready and they had a certain target they wanted to hit, and that's why it came out like a week or two later. But it was a really nice surprise. I thought it was a fun episode, and it tells me that they are going to have the fidelity to the short stories and not forget those as well. It's just going to be interesting because, again, most of the next trade paperback, Dream Country, are single issue stories. Mm-hmm. They don't build anything.
Where Cain and Abel are reading stories of the universe or some bullshit.
Yeah. So, well, what I'm wondering is if they're going to try to like intersperse them, or they're just going to have a whole bunch of done in ones and then have an arc at the back end. Because they saved the story from issue 9 for the next series, and since that's going to tie into Season of Mist, I can see where you'd want to front load that at the beginning of the new season and kind of build towards it. But I'm just curious how they're going to handle that. But I'm looking forward to seeing how, because I still was a little frustrated with the series. I still have my little problems with the show. Paquita, I think, actually liked it better than I did. But I still liked it, and I'm still anticipating the next season. I'll definitely watch it as it comes out. So yeah, you like it overall as well. Aside from the fact that you blew off watching the last fucking bonus episode.
I heard bonus material.
Yeah.
Now
two full stories, one episode. Yeah.
Should have released it when it came out originally.
Because I understand you've been running from the man that goes by the name of the Sandman. He flies the sky like an eagle in the eye of a hurricane that's abandoned. We think you're special. 21st Century Boys. Dr. Ange. Between the Pages Blog. Billy Hines. Borgstad. Brian Dockery. Carlos Folk. Chris Leiden. Chris Maiorino. Dave's Comic Heroes Blog. Ed Moore. El Romero Mero. Nana Raja 3. The Hammer Strikes. Random Geek. E. Stuff. Hector Cantors. History of Comics on Film. Iowa's Joe Is. Jeffrey Brown. JMT Prod. Keith G. Baker. KSCGSF Podcast. MM Beats. Mike It Send Aliens to Me. Men. Moon Cthulhu. My Comic Book Collection 70s to 90s. Official. The Former Guy Parody Nickname Database on FAR Quickie. Rhea Nemike on Hive. Richard Field. Roger Preby. Ronald Clark. Sean McLaughlin. Who added, I have opinions. Sean Phillips. Siskoid. Speak Comics. Superbound. Talk Nerdy to Me. Tim Price. The Pod Crasher. Wibbly Wobbly Dicey Wicey RPG Podcast. Wonder Woman. Warrior for Peace Podcast. Xenozoic Xenophiles. And Zendao 42. Zendao 42 at Universiadan.com.
The preceding program is a non-profit fan production. Any copyrighted materials contained therein are believed borrowed under fair use with no copyright infringement intended. Please feel free to leave comments at the Rolled Spines Productions WordPress blog. You can also send us Twitter comments through the Rolled Spine Podcast Twitter. Thank you for listening.